Continuing education credits for physicians and other healthcare professionals are provided by VCU Healthcare Continuing Education. Check out cribsiders.vcuhealth.org for more information. The Cribsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and informational purposes only. The views and statements expressed in this podcast are solely of those of the hosts.
Welcome back to the Cribsiders. I'm Chris the Chew Manchu, and I'm joined by my co-host, Dr. Sam Mazur. Say hi, buddy.
Hey.
And our super producer, Jennifer Chisholm. Welcome back.
Hi, very happy to be back.
So tonight we have a great guest, Dr. William Bo Mitchell, here to discuss ITP. We're very excited about this episode, but first, Sam, remind us, what is this show about?
Chris, I would love to remind you about what this show is about. We are the Pediatric Medicine Podcast. We interview leading experts in the fields to bring clinical pearls, practice-changing knowledge, and answering lingering questions about core topics in pediatric medicine.
We have a fantastic conversation with our guest, Dr. Mitchell. Dr. William Bo Mitchell is an associate professor of pediatric hematology oncology at CHAM Children's Hospital at Montefiore, where he is director of hemostasis and thrombosis. His primary clinical focus is pediatric hematology, with expertise in diagnosing and treating rare bleeding disorders, and with a special interest in platelet disorders. Dr. Mitchell's clinical research has focused on novel therapies for rare bleeding disorders and sickle cell anemia, and his basic science research has focused on mechanisms of action of novel ITP therapies, platelet function in sickle cell disease, and the production of platelets from stem cells. Dr. Mitchell teaches us the fundamentals of how to recognize, diagnose, and manage ITP.
Jennifer, I think people will really like this episode. Should we get into it?
Well, we have a lot on our plate. So let's simplify the topic.
Welcome, Dr. Mitchell, to the show.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
Because we're sort of an informal group, is it okay if we call you by your first name? Is it Bo?
Yes, Bo is good.
Excellent. So just a little warm up, you know, just to get to know you for our audience. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and maybe something that's non-medical that you want us to know about?
Sure. I'm a platelet biologist. My favorite cell and subject is the platelet. Most of my patients have problems with their platelets, which is why they come to me. I love classical hematology and all things hematology. I've been doing this for quite a while, and so I've seen a lot of stuff, which maybe we can talk about during this interview. And something that's not medical. I love to build things like cabinets, and I was a carpenter before I was a doctor. So I like to. I used to build barns and houses. Now I just build cabinets and furniture. So
wow,
it's
amazing. Do you use? Do you like hand tools or do you use a lot of machinery?
I do the hand tools actually. I do all my cuts. And it's fun. It's a learning curve, but it's fun.
Very cool. Very cool.
What have you made most recently?
Most recently, I finished a nice cabinet in my wife's study. The project before that was where I'm sitting. You can't see it, but I have a floor to ceiling. We have a 15-foot ceilings cabinet with space for library books and closed cabinets and a nice walnut desk for me to sit at. That was a lot of fun to make.
Very cool. Very cool.
Amazing. Amazing.
Jennifer, you got a question?
Yes. So as a resident, I feel like I love hearing guests answer this question because it always makes me feel a lot better. But I was wondering if you could tell us, what is your favorite failure and what did you learn from it?
Yeah, that's a tough question because I have a tough answer to it. One of my most special patients of all time had inherited immune disorder, and we couldn't figure out what it was and couldn't figure it out. And then finally, after about a year of being at my present institution, we figured out what it was, and we found a genetic cause for it, and we found something that could be a targeted therapy for it. And so we started that, and maybe they were getting a little better, maybe not. And we kept trying to do everything we could to sort of reverse this process for this person because they were really getting more and more ill as time went on. And then COVID hit, and this person got COVID, and it never went away, and she succumbed to COVID eventually. So, and I felt like such a failure because I felt like we had worked so hard and we were so close to having something that would help treat her. And what I learned from that was that the only thing that the parents and the family cared about was that they knew how much I loved their daughter. And that was the only, that was the most important thing to them. They didn't care less about all these genes and immunology and special medicines. They just wanted to know that I had really cared for and loved their child. So that was a big fail and a big win at the same time. Lesson learned.
Thank you for sharing that. I'm definitely going to remember that.
Yeah, that's super special. I don't know if my next question is really, you know, has much to compare against that. But, you know, I think we've all learned from that piece and appreciate you for sharing that. I will kind of take it a little bit in the opposite direction, more from the positive standpoint, if that's okay. Mm-hmm. You know, the best advice, you know, we are all growing, we're all trying to learn. Is there any advice that you'd recommend, either advice you received as a learner or advice you received as a teacher, you know, that we think that our listeners should know?
I've had a few great pieces of advice over the years, and one that really resonates with me is, and I think of it every day, is that no matter the advice is, no matter what the situation, how difficult it is, if you approach it with patience and courage, you'll be able to solve it. So I always try to remember that, patience and courage.
Excellent. Excellent. Should we go ahead and jump into some cases?
Yeah, let's talk about platelets. Does everyone want to talk about platelets?
I think that's why people are here, right?
I feel like that's what people are here for. Let's do it. Jennifer, go ahead, read the case.
Let's be honest. Keeping up with peds literature is hard. Over a million new articles hit PubMed every year, and only a handful really change how we care for kids. But if you miss the few articles that matter, it means missing out on better care for your patients. That's why we're into JournalFeed. JournalFeed.org is written by practicing pediatricians who scan the literature and send you quick, high-yield summaries of the most important peds and primary care articles right to your inbox every weekday. Each summary gives you the bottom line up front, the quote spoon feed, plus a super short practical summary. You'll get smarter in just 2 to 3 minutes a day. It's fast, it's easy, and honestly, it's fun. And you can even earn CME credit. So, Cribsiders listeners, try JournalFeed free for 7 days and get 20% off your first year with code CRIB25 at journalfeed.org/cribsiders. That's journalfeed.org/cribsiders, code CRIB25.
So I have a case from Kashlek Children's Outpatient Clinic. So Violin is a 3-year-old girl who presents to a PCP for an ED follow-up visit. 1 week ago, she was seen in an ED with URI symptoms and had a CBC checked. Violet's father reports that the ED doctor told them to follow up because the CBC showed a low platelet count of 38,000 and was otherwise normal. Violet has recovered from her URI symptoms. And when you ask about bleeding symptoms, Violet's dad noticed that she just in general always has a lot of bruises as an active 3-year-old and hasn't sort of noticed any changes. So to begin with, could you begin by taking us through how you are thinking about a patient like Violet sort of based on that information and what differentials you'd be considering?
That is a great case. I have all kinds of light bulbs going off in my head. The first thing that I'm thinking about is the presentation. So combination of a viral syndrome with low platelets makes you sort of jump on the acute or newly diagnosed ITP bandwagon, but then the platelets are not that low, and they're not really low enough to have acute bleeding. And the timing is kind of funny because the platelets usually don't drop until after the viral syndrome, and so it makes me wonder if this girl has ever had a normal platelet count. So I'd really want to find out from her pediatrician if she's ever had a platelet count before. So my other light bulb is that this could just be the uncovering of a inherited platelet problem. So I would want to go down both of those paths and see what falls out.
And before we even kind of talk about workup and stuff like that, we are going to talk about ITP. From a differential diagnosis standpoint, it sounds like malignancy or other types of those are not really under differential with a case like that. Is that correct? You're really thinking of two big, big things. And I was just wondering why that's the case and kind of how your differential is just kind of two categories.
That's a great question. One of the most important things that I've learned as a clinician is to tell when a child is extremely ill or is not extremely ill. And I've seen enough kids with leukemia to tell that those kids are usually really sick and they don't look well. And I've seen enough kids with ITP to know that those kids usually look fine. And they are usually bouncing off the walls to everyone's distress. And they don't usually look seriously ill like the kids with leukemia have. So I was about to say I'd been wrong once, but I wasn't wrong because I never actually diagnosed them with ITP. I made them wait, and after a couple of weeks, they presented with leukemia. So it does hold true that for the most part, you can tell a really sick kid from a really well kid.
One quick question. So we've said the word ITP a couple times.
Yeah.
Can you help us define exactly what ITP means and maybe some of the pathophys?
Sure. The current meaning is the idea. excuse me. The current meaning is immune thrombocytopenia. So ITP. The first iteration of that was idiopathic thrombocytopenia purpura. Which idiopathic because we didn't know what caused it, and thrombocytopenic purpura because the platelets were low and it was causing bruising or purpura or petechia. But that's been shortened to immune thrombocytopenia because now we know that it's an immune-mediated disease, and we know that it's the thrombocytopenia is the cause of the bleeding symptoms, and so it's a simpler name. The pathophysiology of it is it's very complex. The general big bucket of diagnosis is the immune system, which has somehow decided that the platelets are foreign antigens and is making antibodies against them. And then those antibodies are taken up by the macrophages in the reticuloendothelial system of the liver and the spleen as well. There are many other ways to get immune thrombocytopenia, and it's probably a kind of a one bucket for many different types of immune processes that turn out to have the same phenotype. So some people with ITP are not going to respond to the usual therapies, and so they probably have ITP of another flavor, and they need a different type of therapy. And so we're finding pockets of people with ITP that don't respond to the usual therapies, but they'll respond to something else. We don't really have really specific diagnostic terms for those patients. So they all have ITP, but they do. We are separating them out into different phenotypes.
If we bring sort of the conversation back to Violet, our 3-year-old, mm-hmm. So you'd mentioned that sort of one thing that you were thinking is, you know, ITP. Tends to present to children who's well appearing, bouncing off the walls. Can you tell me a little bit more about how you see ITP commonly present?
Sure. The most common presentation is a child about Violet's age, typically coming to the emergency room, sent by the pediatrician, covered from head to toe with spots and bruises. They, for some reason, they all are just bouncing off the wall and really unnerving everyone, and their platelets are usually extremely low, it's like in the single digits. That's the from the hospital point of view, that's kind of the most common presentation that we see. In the clinic, we see the patients with the more insidious onset, who's maybe don't have symptoms, but their platelets were found to be low on their annual visit CBC. And those will be referred just to the clinic, and we can evaluate them there. And those are, they're a little different. They respond a little differently sometimes to therapy, and they're kind of a different cat, and they're a little older. They're usually the teenagers. So they're a little bit of a different category than the younger school age kids who get the full on ITP with super low platelets.
So you were mentioning ages. What age group is ITP overall most common in?
It's most common in adults, actually, but there's a peak around school age kids. So in my experience, anywhere from like 3 to 7, those are the kids that we see mostly that get the very low platelets, usually a viral presentation, and then they usually, with or without therapy, get better after a few months. The teenagers, the older kids, those kids tend to have not so low platelets, and they tend to not necessarily need any therapy. And they also tend to not necessarily resolve in a few months. So a lot of those will go on to become chronic, which is after a year of having ITP.
Yeah. And one sort of final follow-up question about this common presentation. As someone who's sort of a resident and still kind of honing my clinical skills, I do find it tricky sometimes when it comes to bruising, especially in the toddler age group and for young children. Sometimes they have so many bruises. What's kind of your rule of thumb of, in, for example, a toddler age group, what degree of bruising would start to concern you or strike you as abnormal?
So one rule is that the bruises should be flat. If they're really raised and you can really feel them and they're hematomas, that's not normal. If they hit themselves that hard and got a hematoma, they probably need to go to the emergency room. And then the other thing is the size. So people with platelet disorders often will get bruises the size of their palm, like they can be really big. And typically regular bruises are smaller. Even on active toddlers, the bruises are usually relatively small, like a centimeter or so less. But the bruises with ITP can be very big. And really alarming looking.
That actually brings up a follow-up question. At what plate, in your experience, at what platelet level would you expect to have kind of bruising and or symptoms? What's your kind of cutoff in your head?
That's a great question. It's actually a really tricky question in ITP because the patients with ITP sometimes don't have bruising or bleeding even down to platelet counts in the single digits. Whereas if my platelets went to 10, I would be bruising and bleeding all over the place. So it's a little trickier in the kids with ITP. So I don't really tell the parents, if there's no bruising or bleeding, the platelet count is fine, because that may not be true. The platelet count may be 1,000. So it's difficult to tell in ITP, to be honest with you. But generally, around 10,000 or so, you start to see more bruising and petechia and then the mouth lesions and all of that.
So if I'm at 30 to 50,000 or something like that, I might not have any, symptoms regardless of what my disease process is. And then you were kind of mentioning also that platelets, we gave the patient the initial platelet count is 38,000. Mm-hmm. Is there a level with which you'd say this could be ITP or not ITP? Do you have a cutoff, for example, on your platelet number?
Well, the definition is under 100. So anything under that, really. I think the highest platelets that I've seen in ITP is, I'm trying to think of who has the highest platelets in ITP. I have had a patient in the 90s, in the 90,000s. So it does get up that high and it can be a little variable.
So my next question is, say I'm the pediatrician seeing this child, and based on the physical exam, I have ITP high in my differential. Mm-hmm. I had only just done like a quick CBC just because I was worried, and now I think it is. What type of workup should I be doing in the office setting, or is this something that I need to send directly to the hospital, or what would I be doing? What would I be testing?
My advice for what workup to do after you get that platelet count is send them to some place where they'll be seen by a hematologist. So send them to the emergency room. If they don't have a lot of symptoms, send them to our clinic. We and most other hematologists will see a patient with low platelets the same day. It's an urgent matter that should be looked at pretty quickly.
I'll follow that up with, we love to try to figure out on this show what is happening at that first office visit when we see that subspecialist. So say we refer over there, what test are you ordering then? And what are you looking at so we can kind of do that next step if we want to?
So I am doing my assessment from the door. Is this a very sick child or is this a well child? I'm doing my exam of them. What are their bleeding symptoms looking like? Are they someone who's covered with bruises and petechia, or are they somebody who doesn't have any bleeding symptoms? So, and those are two different buckets of patients. If they are a school-age child and they're covered with bruises and petechia, and they're having some bleeding in the mouth, then I need to go down the path of figuring out, you know, do I want to treat them? And what lab tests have to happen before we can do that? If they're a teenager and their platelets are not that low, I'll probably want to do just a basic immune type workup. And we can talk about that a little bit too, but and go down the path, that path with them. So a little bit different depending on how they look. If they look ill, then they're going right to the emergency room from clinic.
I see. So if you are sort of thinking about doing a bit more workup in clinic because they're not sick looking, what's sort of that initial workup? So you mentioned sort of immune workup. Would that be an ANA, immunoglobulins, anything else?
Usually the ANA and the immunoglobulins are the main thing. I usually will just send the thyroid studies just because that can cause low platelets. And the, what else do we send?
And we're talking about total immunoglobulins or?
Yeah, just the subsets, just the, IgA, IgG, not E, but IgA, IgG, IgM. Just looking for the occasional patient that has severe combined immune deficiency, which happens every once in a while. So it is important to send it. And that's about it. Those are the main things that we send.
And when you say thyroid labs, are you just doing TSH or are you doing TSH,
Just the TSH. Yeah, just the TSH. And the other thing that I usually send is a direct antiglobulin test, a Coombs, just to make sure they don't have also another cell line that has immunity against it. So like an Evans syndrome, which is when you have immune destruction of two cell lines.
Great. And you mentioned that sort of a virus preceding or sort of an infectious trigger preceding acute ITP is common. Do you ever find that it's useful to sort of send up any kind of infectious workup, or is that not usually useful sort of for a first visit in clinic?
We don't usually do it for the first visit because they're usually well by the time we see them, actually. It's usually a week or two before. For the ones that do have low platelets and they're still sick, then we would probably send, you know, looking for EBV, Epstein-Barr virus, that kind of thing, something that could cause splenomegaly even to make the platelets low, that kind of thing.
So let me just see, let's just kind of summarize this for a second, and then I just have a follow-up question. So it sounds like we'll just say, you know, the platelets are 10 for a really well-appearing child and had a virus 2 weeks ago, and you're like, this is probably ITP. You said you're going to send an ANA, immunoglobulins, and thyroid studies. For the ANA, I am...
Probably not on them.
Oh, gotcha, because you feel like that one's so slam dunk. So say you didn't have a viral trigger that was clear for you, but you're looking for that other trigger. So say everything else of that case is the same. The ANA, what are you looking for on the ANA from that category? Because I don't know of any like specific anti-nuclear antigen that has, you know, is an anti-ITP one.
So the rate of positive ANA and ITP is something like 35-40%. It's actually very high. And those kids are the kids that are at risk for going on to develop lupus. So it's good to find that up front, and then we can refer them to our rheumatology colleagues to get a workup from them as well, because ITP can be the first sign of lupus. Awesome. And it can happen... I've seen it happen, you know, a year before they develop lupus, so it can really take a while. So that's the reason for the ANA, looking for kids who are at risk for developing lupus. And that's typically in the teenagers. So not necessarily the school-age kids.
Any other trigger tests that you might send?
We always get a smear, a peripheral blood smear, to look at under the microscope. It's really important to look at the white cells, make sure they're all looking completely normal, unless there's activated lymph looking like a viral infection. I always look at the red cells because red cells are important. And then I look at the platelets. The platelets in ITP are usually absent. And the ones that are there are often really big because there are young platelets being thrown out of the marrow. So looking for those typical findings. If the platelets were all uniformly large and it didn't have that picture of looking like ITP platelets, which are either absent or huge, then that would make me think maybe there's an inherited platelet problem going on here. But I always look at the smear before doing anything, any kind of treatment.
So let me just summarize just to see. If we have a case of ITP, or we presume to be ITP, it sounds like there's no diagnostic test to say this is automatically ITP. Mm-hmm. Instead, it sounds like if you have a clear trigger, and we'll kind of go through those in a second, then you can kind of let that relax. But if not, you're certainly getting an ANA for an association with lupus, immunoglobulins associated with any sort of immunodeficiency, a peripheral smear to really look at those and also see the other lines, as well as a TSH, free T4, whatever you reflex it to see if you have thyroid disease. Mm-hmm. Is that an appropriate summary?
Yeah, I think that's about it.
Okay.
And there's a reason behind doing all these tests up front. Because one of the treatments, and we'll maybe talk about treatments at some point, mm-hmm. is to give immune globulins. And so you can't do a lot of these tests after you give immune globulins because they're nullified by the immune globulins.
Do you feel like you can never get ahead of charting? Imagine a world where you don't need to think about notes again. Introducing Freed, an AI medical scribe built to free clinicians everywhere. It listens, transcribes, and writes instant clinical notes for you in your style. Freed can be used across all specialties for in-office as well as virtual visits, and it works in multiple languages. Written in your style and ready the moment the visit is over, all you have to do is copy it into your EHR. Freed is HIPAA compliant and only takes seconds to learn. Over 15,000 clinicians, including doctors, APPs, therapists, use Freed to save up to 2 hours every day and free themselves from documentation. Just imagine the great feeling of coming home without any notes hanging over your head. Get back to doing what you love and let Freed do the rest. Start your free trial today, no credit card needed. Use code CURB50 to get $50 off your first month when you subscribe. That's code CURB50 to get $50 off your first month when you subscribe. CURB50 to get $50 off your first month when you subscribe.
What are your classic triggers for ITP?
I have to admit, I'm not a person so focused on triggers, but typically there's some story of a viral syndrome like in the last week or two. The other thing that we see is actually post the MMR vaccine. I've seen that a few times. And then the most recent thing too, which is alarming, is the COVID vaccine ITP, or is TTP actually, which fortunately we didn't see too much of. And as far as other triggers, we don't actually know what causes ITP, so we don't have a good answer for that. Yeah, it would be great if we could say, check this box for ITP and check this box for not ITP, but we don't know what to label that box.
Out of curiosity, so mm-hmm. for those children who do have ITP that is possibly triggered by either COVID vaccination or MMR vaccination, how do you counsel them about future vaccines?
That is a great question. That's been studied. We don't generally like them to get that vaccine while they're in the midst of ITP. So we're usually talking about a year of not getting it. But then after the ITP is gone, if it goes away, kids are actually not at risk for getting it again if they get the MMR again. And the COVID vaccine is very interesting because there was actually a study during COVID showing that the risk of getting a platelet reaction, so having thrombocytopenia from the COVID vaccine, it doesn't depend on what happened to you the first time. So if you had a decrease the first time, you may not have a decrease the next time, and vice versa. So you can imagine that makes it difficult to counsel patients on what to do, because we're basically saying it's a toss-up. We don't, you know, we can't predict. We do know that for that specific instance, getting COVID was much worse than getting the vaccine. So we were recommending, that was the party line to recommend getting the COVID vaccines for people with ITP.
Speaking of things that we give to patients that may cause thrombocytopenia, are drug-induced thrombocytopenias within the realm of ITP, or are they considered something separate?
Oh, that's a great question. So drug-induced thrombocytopenias can be immune-mediated. So there are some drugs that cause an immune reaction, which can be when a new epitope is formed with the drug and the platelet, and causes the antibody to bind there. It can be that response, and those are interesting because you can actually test for them if you send the platelets to a place that can test for it, and the New York Blood Center does that in New York. I don't know where else people send out their testing, but they can test for the antibody binding in the presence of the drug. And then it gives you a very clean answer of what's going on with the drug and the platelets of the person. So,
are there common drugs that we need to worry about, or is it just, it can be anything?
Common drugs are antibiotics and anti-epilepsy drugs, especially the valproic acid can do that. I've seen that a few times. And yeah, that's the one that we see most, actually, as far as having a definite immune attack upon the platelets.
That makes sense. It lines up pretty well with also our other disease processes that are caused by drugs. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I assume once we discontinue drugs, it would help treat the cause, but also maybe we would never give those drugs again because of the same issue?
Yeah, you would have a recrudescence of it. Usually when you stop the drug, it stops within a couple of half-lives of the drug, because the antibody won't bind the platelets without the drug present. So it's a very quick turnaround.
I think we've been teasing treatment for a little bit,
yeah,
and Chris kind of got into it, you know, right now. Jennifer, if you want to kind of read the rest of our case so we can kind of start talking about treatment.
Yep. So getting back to Violet. So Violet's PCP orders a repeat CBC. And the CBC again demonstrates isolated thrombocytopenia, this time of 6,000. She remains well appearing and has no active bleeding symptoms. So how would you sort of start to thinking about an initial management approach for acute ITP?
That's a great presentation and a great case. So acute ITP light bulb is brighter now going off, and my inherited thrombocytopenia light bulb is getting dimmer. The treatment really depends on what the patient looks like, meaning are they really bleeding a lot? If the patient is looking well and has a few bruises and a few petechiae, and does not have any bleeding from nosebleeds or bleeding in the mouth with wet purpura, which are those blood blisters that develop in the mouth, then that person doesn't really need to be treated. They can just be observed. And their course is most likely going to be a very easy one. The kids that come in who have, they're just covered with petechiae and bruises from head to toe. I think the official number is 100 petechiae. If you have more than 100 petechiae, then you're at a treating level. I personally don't count them. But if they're covered from head to toe, that's got to be 100 at least. And it's usually binary. They're usually either covered with petechiae or not covered with petechiae. So it's usually an easy choice. And if they have, especially if they have wet purpura in the mouth, so those the blood blisters that happen in the mouth, then those would be in the category that would need to be treated, in my opinion. And it's been going around in circles for years, but the current first-line therapy is recommended to be a course of steroids. And people do different things. They have different regimens, but generally a short course of steroids. And it's something that they can take by mouth at home. They don't have to be admitted. And most of the time that will bring their platelet count up in about 3 days or so. And then follow-up care and treatment is like a whole subject by itself. Maybe we'll talk about it a little bit more. The other first-line therapy is the immune globulin. And that used to be some people's first-line therapy over in steroids because it does increase the platelet count faster. And there's some... there's some sense in thinking that if somebody is actually bleeding, then you would want to probably do the immune globulin up front because it brings the platelet count up faster. But I would argue if somebody's actively bleeding, like having heavy menstrual bleeding or a lot of nosebleeds, that you'd probably want to give both the immune globulin and the steroid, you know, a much higher dose of the steroid together at the same time to decrease the bleeding. But for Violet, probably if she had lots of bruises and petechia and some wet purpura, she would go home with a short course of steroids.
I was wondering if you did in a very brief way, and I don't know if this is possible, but kind of take us through just a little bit of the data between steroids and IVIG, because it's bounced back and forth just in the last 7 years since I've graduated medical school. And I just want to have a broad strokes understanding of what is it durability? Is it immediacy? You know, kind of what's the thing?
To be honest, it's more, instead of bouncing back and forth, I think of it more as a wearing blender of platelets and IVIG and steroids. And a lot of it depends on who you trained with, where you trained. There's really not a lot of hard data on one being more efficacious than the other. There was some, I can't remember where it was from, but some evidence which was all retrospective on giving IVIG first made them more likely to have a chronic disease, which is, I don't think is the case. I think that's a selection bias. There's not a lot of hard data. There's no study to answer that question definitively. The real treatment choice is whether you want to bring those platelets up today or tomorrow morning, or do you want to bring them up in 3 or 4 days at home? And it depends on how the person is looking. If the person is looking like Violet, who seems to be doing okay, and I think she's not having a lot of bruising and bleeding, then she's somebody who could go home with just the oral steroid course and then follow up in a few days after the platelet should have come up a bit. But if it's somebody who came in who was covered with bruises and petechia and had wet purpura in the mouth, you might consider doing the immune globulin for that person, depending on their activity level and depending on what their home situation was, et cetera.
When you say send them home with corticosteroids, can you describe exactly what that regimen might look like?
Sure. It would be my go-to regimen is 2 milligrams per kilogram per day divided twice, so BID. And I usually do 5 days. And that usually bumps them up enough, actually plenty, over the course of the next few weeks. And sometimes we'll get them all the way through their ITP course, and sometimes you would need to treat them again, potentially. But if they respond to that, then typically they're going to do well.
When you say that you may need to retreat them, how often are you following labs on them? And is it just mostly a CBC that you're following?
Oh, that's a great question. So for sort of the more straightforward kids with ITP, I'll start off weekly, unless they're really bleeding a lot. If they're not bleeding a lot, like Violet, I would say that she could probably come back to clinic in a week, and we would check the platelets again. And then I would probably follow her for 2 more weeks. And if she is doing fine and stable, then I would go for 2 weeks. And that just continues. And what I tell the families and what I've experienced is that all the treatments that we give them, it doesn't modify the disease. It's not a cure. It's just stopping the symptoms long enough for the disease to go away by on its own, long enough for it to burn itself out.
So you say that, you know, we're only sort of helping with symptoms. And so previously you said that a viable strategy is also just observation and not mm-hmm. treatment, correct? Mm-hmm. So is that follow-up the same? Are you following them with CBCs every week to monitor, make sure they're improving? And then I guess, and then I have one more question after that, actually.
Yeah, if the platelets are low, but they're not having a lot of bleeding, I will definitely want to follow them until their platelets are clearly showing signs of going up, which would mean up over 20,000 would make me very happy. So it's usually going to be weekly for a few weeks until they start to recover and just go from there. Again, spacing out, I space out a little timidly. And also I would have them go, they could go to their pediatrician in 2 weeks and then come back to me in a month, like that kind of thing. And just kind of spread it out.
I know if I was a parent and I had a child with this bruising and possibly a little bit bleeding, but then you felt like, you know, they were doing probably well enough that they just needed observation. What does that discussion look like with the parent? Do you have a sort of a spiel or a script that you talk to them to educate the family? This is what ITP is and this is the expected mm-hmm. course?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I do. Would you like me to reiterate that?
I would love to hear it, just so we can.
So my first goal is to reassure the families once I've seen the smear, reassure the families that their child does not have leukemia, because that's probably what everybody has told them, from the pediatrician to the emergency room to the taxi driver. And so I just want to reassure them that it's not leukemia, their child doesn't have that. And that usually is very helpful, because that's usually what they're thinking. And then I talk to them about the platelets, what the platelets are, sort of how they function a little bit, and what happens if they're low, and how low they have to be for that to happen, and sort of where their child is in that framework. For somebody whose platelets are 6, that's concerning, more concerning. For somebody whose platelets are 70, they could have surgery, so it's less concerning. So that we kind of go from there. And then we talk about what immune thrombocytopenia means and what that is, meaning that for some reason the body has decided that the platelets are, these platelets, those tiny little cells, are foreign objects and they need to be attacked and killed. And so the body's making antibodies against those platelets to kill them. And so what we need to do is to find some way to either, if needed, stop that process from happening, or if it's not too severe, just wait it out and it will usually go away in a few months. That's kind of where I go with that.
And just a follow-up question about first-line treatment for acute ITP. So you mentioned mm-hmm. it's steroids or immunoglobulins, and there's not a ton of evidence, but generally steroids first. When you say immunoglobulins, do you mean exclusively IVIG, or are you putting anti-D in that category as well?
Oh, that's a great question. I don't know how much I should say about anti-D, because I have not had a good experience with it, and so I don't use it that much. So maybe I can just leave it at that. It's not my go-to. The immunoglobulin that we use is, in fact, IVIG, and not the the anti-D. It's the big dose of IVIG, and I use the higher dose, the 1 gram per kilo, and the 1 gram per kilogram on day one, and then again on day two if necessary. And the reason for using the big dose is because there's in all that big bottle of IVIG, there's a tiny fraction that has the right glycosylation pattern that actually stops the immune process that's causing the B cells to make all those antibodies. And so you have to give enough of it to make that happen. And so the IVIG does many different things. One thing that it does is it turns off the dendritic cells and resets the immune system, basically. And you have to give enough of it to make that happen. So the more IVIG you give, the worse side effects you have. And the steroids given at the same time can actually help the side effects. But it's a lot. It can be difficult for the kids to take the IVIG at that dose.
That was going to be my next question is, you know, we're talking about first-line treatments as corticosteroids or IVIG right now. Yeah. At what point, what if they're not responding to which one you chose? Like, would you maybe start IVIG? Well, say they were going home on corticosteroids, they seem to be getting worse. Would you then bring them in to do IVIG? Or even if they're in, you start IVIG inpatient and they don't seem to respond, would you start corticosteroids?
You are practically a hematologist now, so that's pretty much what happens. So if the corticosteroid doesn't work in a few days to, you know, 5 to 6 days when we check again, then and the count is going down or they're having bleeding, then they're going to get immune globulin. And typically I would give immune globulin with a big dose of methylprednisolone IV at the same time, because if they didn't respond to that steroid dose, they're probably not going to respond to any continued lowish dose of steroids. They're going to need a real slug of it to have any effect. And typically the immune globulin and the methylprednisolone work pretty well together. And the methylprednisolone can help mitigate some of the symptoms from the immune globulin, so the headaches and the nausea, vomiting.
Summer's here. More sun, more light, more time to do all the things that make summer so special. And the number one thing you don't want to be doing all summer? Working in the hospital. Well, you can't get out of that one, but how about spending hours cooking inside? That's where Factor comes in. Factor chef-crafted, dietitian-approved meals are ready in just 2 minutes, taking the hassle out of eating well. With 45 weekly menu options, you can pick gourmet meals that fit your summer gains and goals. Choose from options like Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, Keto, and more. Factor powers your day, sun up to sundown. With nutritious breakfasts, on-the-go lunches, premium dinners, and guilt-free snacks and desserts, Factor has your whole day covered. In medicine, time is our most valuable resource. If you're a resident working 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., how are you going to cook, sleep, and exercise? Well, that's easy. Use Factor and remove all the cooking time with delicious meals. If you're a student, how are you going to go to rotations from 7 a.m. to 5 p.m., study, cook, exercise, and sleep? Well, same thing. Factor is ready in just 2 minutes. All the meals are nutritious, delicious, and ready to go. Enjoy more this summer. Get Factor if you want all the flavor and none of the fuss. So, Cribsiders listeners, get started at factormeals.com/cribsiders50off and use code cribsiders50off to get 50% off plus free shipping on your first box. That's code cribsiders50off at factormeals.com/cribsiders50off for 50% off plus free shipping. factormeals.com/cribsiders50off.
Are there any second-line treatments then you start looking at if they fail both steroids and IVIG, or is that all we have available?
Wow, that's a loaded question. There are several things that are in the second-line category. Interestingly, the things that have moved up the ladder on the second-line categories are the thrombopoietin receptor agonists, and there are two that are approved in pediatrics. And so if they don't respond to the immune globulin and steroids, we'll probably do it again, maybe a couple of times to really convince ourselves that it's not working. And then we may have to go to, depending on their symptoms, we may have to go to second-line therapies. So second-line therapies would be, in pediatrics anyway, would be the thrombopoietin receptor agonists. And My other second-line therapy is actually rituximab, the anti-CD20 antibody. But I typically will go to the receptor agonists first at this point in time because they have such a good track record.
And so I have a couple follow-up questions regarding that. So the first is how, essentially, I'm trying to frame it in, like, what does it mean to fail? You know, so we said, for example, if there was an outpatient, we would give, a 5-day course of corticosteroids. And by the way, I presume it's prednisone when you're referring to 1 mg/kg BID. But the we would give that, and so then
I give two mgs per kg daily. Oh yeah, 1 mg/kg BID. You're correct. I'm sorry.
Yeah, my fault. But when you're, you know, I assume, like, okay, you get a little bit of response next week. up, now it's low again, we do it again. Yep. You know, like how many times would you do that in a row before you would consider it failure?
That is a good question. Some of it depends on how bad the failure is. If they come off of the first course of the prednisone with low platelets but don't bleed, then I wouldn't consider that a failure. I wouldn't be too unhappy with that, and I'm just going to watch them and see what they do clinically. If they just tank their platelets and start bleeding despite the steroids, then it's unlikely they're going to respond to another course of it. And then we would probably switch to the immune globulin and methylpred. But I think the kids will show us what works for them and what is not working for them pretty rapidly. It's pretty easy to tell. If the patient has a great response to the immune globulin and the high-dose methylprednisolone, but it lasts for 2 weeks, which happens sometimes, I would try it again because maybe the next time it will last for 4 weeks. Yeah. And we just have to kind of make up the schedule as we go along, depending on how they respond.
And so just take the bleeding patient for a second. Mm-hmm. You know, we all got to know what happens when you give them platelets.
That's a great question. What happens when you give them platelets? All of the doctors and nurses in the room give a sigh of relief. Ah, they're getting platelets. That's the main
the
thing that happens.
2,000. Yes. We got to give them something.
Yes. And that's the main effect, basically. We usually, if we give them platelets, we'll do a 1 hour post platelet count. And depending on how that is, it can give us a clue to how severe the destruction is of the platelets. If it's back down to 2 in an hour, then they're going through platelets a lot. If it's 10 or if it's 15, then, you know, and maybe it's helping a little bit and their disease is not so forceful. So that can give us some information, definitely. If somebody is bleeding, so if somebody comes in with heavy menstrual bleeding or somebody comes in bleeding a lot from, you know, the nose, having hour-long nosebleeds, those patients really should consider getting platelets along with immune globulin and methylprednisolone, kind of throwing the kitchen sink at them to really try and get the bleeding to stop.
Yeah, and then if your hemoglobin's low, they get red cells too, right? They just get,
yeah,
just get everything.
Yeah, get everything.
So we've been talking about acute ITP, which is what Violet has. I was wondering, when is the cutoff when you would start to call ITP chronic?
The current classifications are new onset ITP for the first 3 months, and that's because a fair amount of kids will resolve within 3 months. A lot of them will come in, either they get treatment or not, and either way, their platelets just go up slowly over the next couple of months, and they kind of sail through. The next category is the persistent, which is kind of midway between acute and chronic. And that's from 3 months to a year. And it used to be only up to 6 months, but there are some patients who will spontaneously resolve within a year. And so they kind of want to scrape those patients out of the chronic barrel and put them into the persistent barrel. I think that's a really good idea because I've had several patients who have done great and they resolve their platelets and then they come back at 10 months and their platelets are 6 again. I don't really let them out of my sight until a year has gone up. Even the ones that resolve really well, I make them go back to their pediatrician at least at 6 months and a year to make sure all the platelets are okay. But I think those are good kind of guideposts to judge. And then the chronic ITP is when it lasts for more than a year.
Awesome. Let's talk about treatment options a little bit for chronic ITP. How does that change? I imagine giving a year's worth of corticosteroids is probably not recommended.
Yeah, that would be a disaster. That used to be the only thing we could do, though. And the poor kids would get so much steroids. It was really awful. But now we have so many second and third line options that really can work in a lot of cases. It's actually a golden era of ITP treatment. So where should we start?
Yeah, exactly. Where do you want to start?
So I think sort of the huge windfall for ITP was the thrombopoietin receptor agonist. And there's three on the market now. Only two of them are approved for pediatrics, though. And I think there's another one coming on the market soon. They work by stimulating the thrombopoietin receptor on the megakaryocytes, which are the big cells that make the platelets. And that thrombopoietin receptor makes the megakaryocytes mature, and it makes them make all their platelets. And so the interesting thing about ITP, immune thrombocytopenia, is that it's a combination of destruction of the platelets. The platelets get destroyed, but there's also a decreased production of platelets, and that is a huge part of the ITP problem. And the reason for that is that the antibodies go into the bone marrow and kill the megakaryocytes before they can make platelets. And so if you look in the bone marrow, there's a lot of megakaryocytes that are usually increased, but they're not making platelets, and they just don't survive long enough to do that. And in the lab, in my experience, the antibodies from people with ITP prevent the megakaryocytes from maturing to the point where they can make platelets. So it's a little both. So if you stimulate the megakaryocytes with this thrombopoietin receptor agonist, you can sometimes overcome that production problem and increase the platelet count in that way. And it doesn't work all the time, but it works a lot of the time.
One question I have is, with these patients who have chronic ITP, I assume there are other complications that we need to worry about. Obviously, ITP itself is sort of an immune-type process, so I assume mm-hmm. they might be immunosuppressed, and then if they're on chronic steroids, then they're also more immunosuppressed. So I think, I assume infections would be one thing we worry about. Are there other types of issues, whether it's renal impairment or other things that we need to be worried about as the pediatrician for these patients who might be dealing with longer-term ITP?
That's a great question. The long-term effects of ITP are definitely partly due to the steroid. That is becoming less as we have more and more second and third line therapies, and more of them are available to children. So we don't use as much steroids as we used to anymore. So that's a good thing. So that really helps the immune system. But some of the other medicines that we use for people who with refractory or who don't respond to the first and second line drugs are immune suppression. Everything else is immune suppression, basically. So those patients are going to be some risk of viral infection. They're going to be at some risk of like just getting the common cold or having pneumonia, that kind of thing, more than the usual person. The other thing that can happen is that they cannot get live vaccines because of the medicines that they get. And so they can get behind on their immunizations like that. So that can be a problem as well. Yep.
And then along those lines that Chris was asking, the thrombopoietin receptor agonists, what are the side effects of those medicines specifically?
Fortunately, those medicines don't have too many side effects. The main side effect of that we see is headache. Some people get headaches from it. I haven't seen anything really severe, but some people do report headaches. I've seen the only severe headaches that I see is from the IVIG. The IVIG can give you horrible headaches. I had one patient actually get aseptic meningitis, which with increased intracranial pressure from the IVIG, which is rare, but it does happen, unfortunately. So it can have a lot of side effects. But from the thrombopoietin receptor agonist, the two that are available, one is an oral medicine. It comes in liquid or pill. And the other is an injection, which does sting to get. So that's not a lot of fun. And it requires a weekly visit to the clinic. But they both have, a good effect on the ITP. And they will often work if the other one doesn't work. So they're not the same medicine. They work differently.
And who are the patients with chronic ITP who end up needing splenectomies? Are they the patients that have sort of just failed absolutely every therapy?
It would be hard to give someone absolutely every therapy. There's just not enough time. But the second line therapies are the thrombopoietic agents and usually the rituximab. And then the third line therapies are the more classic immune suppressive drugs like mycophenolate. One thing I use is sirolimus. That is a good one for immune thrombocytopenia and other things that also are similarly immunosuppressive. So that's when you're getting into the immunosuppression and might want to think about putting them on penicillin prophylaxis. We typically try to avoid having the spleen out in kids. It is, you know, safe-ish to give after like 5 years old or so. Some people do after two, but we really try and save the spleen in the kids. The adult providers tend to have the splenectomy in their second line tier. So they're popping that thing out as soon as they don't respond to therapy, which is changing a little now with the thrombopoietin receptor agonists. So the spleen for me is generally after a year of trying different therapies, and that usually is plenty of time to go through a lot of them. The other third and fourth line therapies that I've used that have worked are even chemotherapy agents like vincristine. I've used a couple times, more than a couple times, and it's actually worked. And I've also used anti-plasma cell agents. And these they're certainly off-label, but the bortezomib, the anti-plasma cell, the multiple myeloma drugs have actually worked super refractory ITP.
Would you be able to tell us a little bit about either your experience or what the research shows, how racial and socioeconomic disparities affect children with ITP?
That's a great question. I've had the privilege of working at a hospital in the richest zip code in the country. And now I have the privilege of working at a hospital in the poorest zip code in the country, all within a few miles of each other in New York, which I won't say anything more about. Personally, I haven't noticed a lot of change in treatment of ITP here. But I've also been very active in really bringing the guidelines of treatment for ITP to the emergency room, to our clinic practice, and really trying to educate people on platelet disorders and ITP, doing grand rounds, reaching out to the pediatricians, that kind of thing. I think, you know, like everything else, I think that there are probably people that are not getting to us because they're not going to the doctor. And that's certainly something that we see. People who have had bruising, bleeding for the past 6 months and didn't come in or didn't think to. So that's a little different than some of the other places that I've worked in New York City. So I think health literacy is really a big issue. Which is not on the patients, it's on us. And I think that outreach has helped a bit because once I started scratching for ITP, it started coming out of the woodwork. There were patients coming in with platelet disorders and ITP, and the numbers really increased over the last few years that I've been here and been really trying to get the message out about platelets. So I think there is a disparity, and I think it can be mitigated somewhat by education and outreach.
Perfect, thanks. And sort of to wrap things up, you know, this has been a fantastic conversation about ITP. I was wondering, you know, from your perspective, what are the big key take-home points that you would want sort of a general audience to remember about ITP?
I think the main thing to remember about ITP is that most of the time it's in children, it's going to go away. It's not always the case with the adolescents, but even then, it's much more likely to go away than in the adult patients. So especially with school age kids, that most of the time is going to go away. The other thing that I would love to share with the pediatricians and the people in the emergency rooms is that don't tell the families that the child has leukemia until there are tests that say the child has leukemia, and leave that to the hematologist to do or not. Because that's one of the most stressful things about the whole episode, is that the parents feel and are told that the kid probably has leukemia. So that's a really stressful thing. That's another take-home point. The other take-home point I would have is that platelet biology is really fun and great to learn about and study and practice. And we really need more platelet biologists to come up and take my place as I grow old and retire. So I'm putting out a plug for more people interested in platelet biology.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for spending the time with us today. I definitely learned a whole bunch, and I'm very sure our listeners did too. Thank you so much.
You're so welcome. Thank you for having me.
The number you have dialed has been changed. The new number is...
This has been another episode of The Cribsiders. Get show notes and sign up for our weekly Knowledge Food Formula Feeds newsletter on our website at www.thecribsiders.com.
We're committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge. And to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts, or contact us at thecribsiders@gmail.com. Special thanks to our producer for the episode, Jennifer Chisholm, and our wonderful social media team on Twitter and Instagram. I've been Sam Mazur.
And I've been Jennifer Chisholm.
And this has been Chris the G-Manchi. Thank you, and good night. And by the way, The Cribsiders is for the kids!
For the kids!